Okay, it's kind of embarrassing how bad I am at budgeting.
Let me see your charges.
Fine.
You spent over $600 on takeout last month.
I can't cook. You know this.
Yes, I have had your disgusting food, but you're literally paying for a meal subscription on top of that.
Whoa, wait. That can't be right.
Look, just get Rocket Money. It shows you all of your expenses in one place and even tracks your subscriptions. And if there's a subscription you don't want, which for you, there are a lot you don't need, you can just cancel right in the app with a few taps.
So you mean I don't have to call anyone to cancel?
Nope. No hold times or anything. And they'll even try to get you a refund on some of the months of wasted money, which is a lot of money for you.
Okay.
And if you thought I was done, I'm not. The app can also help you make a budget that works for your income. Anytime you get close to your spending limits, it alerts you, so you know exactly where your money is going at all times.
All right, I'm in. What do I have to do?
Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. Or download the app from the Apple or Google Play stores.
Bases were named in World War I and World War II when the South was a racial police state.
Welcome to Shield of the Republic, a podcast sponsored by the Bulwark and the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia. I'm Eric Edelman, a counselor at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, non-resident fellow at the Miller Center, and a Bulwark contributor. And I'm rejoined by my partner in all things strategery, Elliot Cohen, Professor Emeritus of Strategy at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies and a contributing writer to The Atlantic. Elliot, how are you?
I'm doing well. Early in the week, Eric, we had our annual gathering of strategic studies alumni from Johns Hopkins, where we both have taught. There were a lot of people present. I wish I'd gotten to speak to each of them. I did not, and I apologize for that. But I can't tell you how many of them came up and said, you know, I listen every week to Shield of the Republic. And some of them indicated they found it therapeutic. Others just like hearing their two old professors jaw at each other. So I just want to give a shout out to all the alumni of the Strategic Studies program at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies who are listening.
I had a similar experience. I was sitting at the advisory board for some of RAND's national security programs yesterday, and both some of our colleagues at RAND, former mutual colleagues in government who are now at RAND, as well as some former members of Congress who sit on the board, told me that they're also at least periodic listeners to Shield of the Republic. So we, you know, I'm flattered that we have that distinguished an audience.
Well, we are grateful, and we'll try to live up to your expectations. One thing I regretted, I've been out of town the last 2 days. I got back about an hour and a half ago, and so I was not able to attend the memorial service for Vice President Cheney. You did. You were actually an honorary pallbearer. And maybe before I introduce our guest, could you say something about it? What it was like, what your thoughts are.
Sure. Well, it was, you know, very moving and beautiful service with a number of terrific comments made by people, memories of Vice President Cheney, from President Bush, of course, from his cardiologist, Dr. Jonathan Reiner, with whom he wrote a book about cardiology after having had a number of, as you know, heart attacks and a number of coronary artery issues. We had a very nice remembrance from Pete Williams, who was my colleague when I served with then Secretary Cheney in the Pentagon. Pete was the spokesperson during the first Gulf War. And then from several of the Cheney grandchildren and from, you know, our friend Liz Cheney. Liz told, a great story that I didn't know about the vice president. You know, as you know, and as I noted in my dispatch encomium to the vice president, he flunked out of Yale twice. Although, as Liz pointed out, he always corrected people and said, I didn't flunk out. I was asked to leave twice. But she talked about the period of time where he was, a lineman in Wyoming, stringing cable around the state of Wyoming before Lynn Cheney, his wife, kind of straightened about and got him on the arc that took him on his really quite extraordinary career. And Liz said that in recent months before he passed. They'd spent a lot of time together, and she learned some details she hadn't known about what he was doing at night when he was laying cable. And Elliot, you'll appreciate this. Apparently, by his kerosene lamp, whether either in a sleeping bag on in the open air or in the cook tent, he read through all six volumes of Winston Churchill's History of the Second World War. So not altogether surprising for those of us who worked for him and knew him, but a revealing anecdote and detail as well. The thing that I think left my wife, the deepest impression on my wife and on me, was the fact that not only was President Bush there, but President Biden and Mrs. Biden were there, Vice President Gore, Vice President Harris, Vice President Quayle, Vice President Pence. Nancy Pelosi, former Speaker of the House. It was truly a sort of bipartisan turnout, and reminded us of a different time when political rhetoric was not as heated as it is now, when there wasn't, you know, early and immediate, you know, reach for invective in describing one's, you know, opponents or political adversaries in the most, you know, awful kinds of terms. And it, you know, given our guest today, it reminded me that, you know, if this kind of thing is left unchecked, you know, ultimately it leads to political violence, including the kind of violence that tore our country apart in the middle of the 19th century. So it was a reminder of a somewhat more civil time politically, which I think all of us at this point are, you know, desperately hoping will return in some form or another.
Yeah, I had a very similar feeling going to another memorial service at the National Cathedral, the John McCain's service, which had a very, very, very similar feel. You know, the one other thing I'll mention just in response to that last comment before I introduce our guest, recently, in what I think was unfortunately an act of quite bad judgment, Senator Lissa Slotkin, Senator Mark Kelly, I think Congressman Crow, a number of other Democratic politicians who were veterans, put together a video clip on it telling members of the armed forces that they're supposed to disobey illegal orders, which is true. But the problem with it was that it also made at least one serious partisan attack on this administration and this president. And this was an appeal to the armed forces. And just as before we got on the air, I saw that President Trump has been lashing out in his usual way. And of course, he, needless to say, escalated this all the way, saying this is sedition. You know, these people should be executed. And you're right. And as you and I have discussed, one of the perils of our time is that political violence, the potential for political violence is out there. I think not on the scale, thank God, of the Civil War, but scary stuff. Speaking of the Civil War, it is my great pleasure to introduce somebody not only who I've admired enormously, but I've had the good fortune to work alongside with at the World War II Museum, National World War II Museum, and who I consider a friend. And that's Brigadier General, retired, Ty Sedgley. He's also Dr. Ty Sedgley. So it's a little bit like dealing with you, Eric. I don't know, am I supposed to call him secretary, ambassador, doctor? I'm going to call him Ty for the purposes of this.
As Henry Kissinger said, you could just refer to me as Excellency.
Yeah, right. We could do that. So Ty was the head of the history department at West Point, long distinguished U.S. Army career, about 30 years, and a very serious historian. He wrote a memoir, which I really believe is one of the best books on the Civil War I've read in decades, called Robert E. Lee and Me, which recounts his growing up in Virginia, aspiring to be a Virginia gentleman who admired Robert E. Lee without bounds. And then as he gradually really began to realize the truth, not only about Lee, but what the Confederacy really was, came to a very, very different view. And who most recently was the vice chair of the committee to rename 10 bases, which had been named after Confederate generals, and which those names were accepted. They were the renaming was done. And then, of course, as we know, Secretary Hegseth has been trying to walk it back with a weird kind of artifice so that, you find some private whose last name is Benning and you rename what was Fort Benning, which was named after a Confederate general, Fort Benning, rather than naming it after Harold and Julia Moore, who were real contemporary heroes. Anyway, Ty has written a book with Connor Williams, who is the historian of the Naming Commission, called A Promise Delivered, 10 American Heroes and the Battle to Rename Our Nation's Military Bases, which it's a wonderful account. There's an account of the commission, but it's mainly an account of who are the people after whom these bases have been named. This, by the way, is Robert E. Lee and me, and I hope we're going to sell some books for you, Ty, because they're books people should read. So, Ty, welcome to Shield of the Republic.
Well, what an honor to be here to two distinguished servants of the nation. It is really my honor to be here. So, Eric Elliott, thank you so much. I can't believe I'm on here. It's really great.
It's great to have you. Could you maybe just to get us started, could you talk a bit about the renaming commission? How did it come about? And then how did you go about picking the names that you picked?
Yeah, so in the summer of 20, as the National Defense Authorization Act, the NDAA, was coming, there was a sense that we should not, or at least among Congress, Senate Republicans and Democrats, which, by the way, the House at the time was Democrat, the Senate was Republican, and President Trump was in office, that maybe we shouldn't have bases named after those who chose treason to preserve slavery. And so that they passed a law in 20 for that National Defense Act to remove everything that commemorated Confederates, from paraphernalia, unit insignia, the names of guided missile cruisers, monuments, anything down to paver stones that commemorated the Confederates, remove, rename, all of it. And then that bill, which was passed, was vetoed by President Trump, and then overridden by that. The only vote that was overridden in the during his first administration by a supermajority in both the House and Senate. So that then became law. Just as he was leaving, President Trump put a couple of people on, but didn't finalize it. And then when President Biden came in, Secretary Austin, then they started this process again. And when they did it, the law said four appointed by the Secretary of Defense, four appointed by the House and Senate Armed Services Committee chair and ranking. So we had three Republicans, one Democrat, and four retired flag or general officers on this committee, headed by Admiral Michelle Howard, the first woman to receive 4 stars in the Navy, the first woman, a Black woman, to have 4 stars over in any service, finest leader I've ever worked for. And so we went about the business of trying to figure out how do we do this. So what we decided was first send out to the services, find everything that commemorates Confederates, get back with us. Eventually, we would find 1,111 things that commemorated the Confederates. Then we gave the mission to them to, they got to choose everything except the 9 base names. And we did the bases ourselves. And so first we went and visited every local base. And when we did that, they always had 2 questions, always the same. Do we have to? And the first one, and the answer was, well, Congress passed the law. This wasn't the Naming Commission that said to do it. It was the United States Congress, the will of the people. So yes, you have to. They got that. The second was, you're changing history. And we said, no, we're changing commemoration. What we mean by that is every year at West Point, we're going to study the Battle of Gettysburg. Every year, George Pickett's going to charge on the third day. Every year, Lee is going to lose because he's a loser and he's going to lose. And that's what we're going to do every year. Commemoration is about who we value. It's about inspiration. So, for instance, we used to have Fort Arnold at West Point, named after Benedict Arnold. But when he chose treason in 1780, they changed it to Fort Clinton. Many of you're of the age you may have
a career before that. I mean, I just want to point that out. But.
A great. And so have you been to Saratoga Battlefield and seen the boot monument?
Yes. Now, this is a bit of an inside joke. Since I always do try to stand up for Benedict Arnold. I do want to stipulate I don't want to have any forts named after him, though. So sorry. Oh,
good. Thank you.
No. I think it's a great point because he has a monument at Saratoga just with his boot. Because he was wounded in combat, the finest combat leader of the American Revolution, but again, chose treason, and we don't want to honor. We can study Arnold, we can study Lee, but we shouldn't honor them. So anyway, we've changed the names of things. Idlewild Airport is today JFK, because we decided to change it. Reagan Airport used to be National, used to be a statue of George III in Manhattan. So anyway, we go and ask the communities about what do they want. And they say they want something that reflects the values that they have today. Somebody who has served, who is about the mission, and somebody associated with the local area. So that's what we decide. Then we put a website up. We got 33,000 names from there. And in that 33,000, some of them were, you know, good. Some of them were interesting. For instance, the number one name for Fort Benning in Georgia was Sherman, William Tecumseh, famous for his march to the sea. Elliot, you're laughing about that because we did not choose William Tecumseh Sherman, even though I love Sherman and the hard war is great. One of the names was Spears, Fort Spears, as in Britney Spears. We also chose not to do that. So then we went back. We did that. We all went there in 2021. In 2022, we did virtual and we necked it down to about 10 for each post, sent it back to them, got their input back, and then announced it in May of 22. And then by the end of 23, they were all redone. So it was and with really nobody said anything bad about it. We finished on time, under budget, returned $1.6 million back to the federal treasury. And 100% of our recommendations were accepted and implemented. That may be a government record.
Let me ask just one quick question, then over to Eric. So there were 10 bases. For one of them, you did not choose to name it after an individual, or there are a couple here where it's two individuals, and that is a former Fort Bragg, which was renamed Fort Liberty. What was the thinking behind that? I mean, you described it in the book, but I think people might be interested in hearing it.
It's a great point. And if there's anyone that we got pushback on, it was that. We went there saying, gosh, we want to name it after Roy Benavidez, who received the Medal of Honor in Vietnam, 6 hours of hell. Reagan presented him with the Medal of Honor and said this would be a movie if you did. I mean, just an incredible story. And he had served in both the 82nd Airborne and in Special Forces. But they said, we don't want to name it after just one person. So part of it was identity politics. And you're thinking, oh, identity politics. What? That between the Airborne and the Special Forces, which share Fort Bragg, and they were loath. So Benavidez, more associated with Special Forces. Special Forces didn't want somebody who was Airborne. So Liberty was something that they could agree on. And a Gold Star mother brought that up. Also, Liberty is in the song of the 82nd Airborne Division. We're the soldiers of Liberty. And Liberty is in the Special Forces motto. So Liberty was a way that that community came together and they were united in this idea of Liberty, led by a 4-star general, Dan McNeil, who came up with that. So we tried Benavidez, but our remit from Congress was clear. Listen to local sensitivities.
It's reassuring to see that Goldwater Nichols has clearly overcome service particularism and solved our jointness problems completely. Ty, I wonder, you know, you talked about the pushback you got about changing history. And a point you make, certainly in the Lee book, is no, actually, it's the people who named a lot of these bases who were changing history, because a lot of this is not an artifact of actual history. It's an artifact of a period in which the South was, quote, redeemed at the end of Reconstruction by native Southern politicians who were in the process of disenfranchising recently enfranchised African-American freedmen and women. And, well, women didn't have the franchise at that point yet. And this, you know, creation of the myth of the lost cause and the veneration of you know, Confederate general officers likely, and not just Lee. I mean, you point out it's also Stonewall Jackson and others, particularly those two. It really is a function of the late 19th century. And then again, kind of in the 20s and 30s, when the Ku Klux Klan is running strong throughout the nation. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because I think it's important for people, you know, I on the surface, the, you know, complaint that, no, you can't change history. I mean, it resonates with me. I'm a historian. I kind of agree with that sentiment, but that's not what this is really about.
No, again, it goes back to commemoration, not history. So imagine that the white South, and often when we say the South, the white is silent with that, because the white South went to war to protect and expand the institution of slavery. They wanted to go expand slavery into California, into Mexico, into Cuba. And what they want to do is a separate nation to do that. And not only did they lose, but with the 13th Amendment ending slavery, the 14th Amendment guaranteeing equal protection under law, and the 15th Amendment, which gave the vote to all men, this is a revolution. And in the Reconstruction period, we started biracial democracy, and we had a senator from Mississippi who was black, a congressman from South Carolina, 2,000 black men held elected office. But then a campaign starting in 1877 of political violence on a scale that's hard for us to imagine, 5,000 black men, women, and children are lynched, a white terror campaign, grotesquely often, to ensure even the language is crazy, redeemers. It's a white supremacist movement that creates, and at that time, the Democratic Party, a one-party racial police state. Every Southern state redoes their constitution to ensure a Jim Crow society, and the Supreme Court, through a series of decisions like Cruikshank and Plessy versus Ferguson, acknowledge that and say it's okay. So that by 1890 to 1910, now every one of the Southern states is a white supremacist state. And then, the only way a black person can go in the courthouse is either as a custodian or as a defendant. And outside of these courthouses go monuments that are put up during this period of time to show, as they would say, the Anglo-Saxons are back in the saddle, that the white people of the South are controlling it completely, much like they did under the slave regime, and that there's a substrata of people, black people of the South, who don't have any means. So the bases were named in World War I and World War II, when the South was a racial police state under the Democratic Party, and the army is segregated. There are two black officers in the interwar period, the Davis, Benjamin O. Davis Sr. and Jr., but they're not allowed to command white troops. That's when these posts were named, and they had no ability to, this wasn't America that we want, that we would commemorate, and that's when those bases were named.
Can I just follow up, Elliot, briefly with one other point, because I think it's really important to understand. The argument that the white Southerners were making, as you point out, in the run-up to the war, and then again in this aftermath, is an explicit repudiation of Jefferson's statement in the Declaration that all men are created equal. They explicitly reject the notion that all Americans are equal, and they're committed to essentially an unequal society and an illiberal one, because it really strikes at the very basis of our liberal democracy. And I think we recently had Laura Field on the podcast talking about some of these illiberal strains that we see cropping up again, because I think that explains some of the appeal in certain quarters of this argument that you can't change history and we need to continue to venerate these, as you point out, these people who betrayed their oath to the United States of America and took up arms against it.
Yeah, actually, speaking of that, I think one of the things that you mentioned in there, which I hadn't fully realized, is that the oath, which actually all three of us have taken, originates during the Civil War, and it's Congress issues it, and it's in a way it's with these traitors who turned against the government, turned against the Constitution in mind. And, I must say that's one of many things that resonated in here. Just one question about the process, and then I've got a whole bunch of questions. But it sounds as though when you were talking about renaming, you didn't get any really specifically Confederate pushback, or did you, from the local population? So, you know, saying, look, we're proud Southerners, and you know, Benning is a name that we cherish down here, or something like that, or did you?
Well, they mostly didn't know who they were. And so when I went down and talked at Fort Benning, I'd say, you know, here's who Henry Benning was. Just so you know, he never served a day in the U.S. Army. He killed U.S. Army soldiers. And he wrote, he was a fire eater, someone who tried to break apart the United States starting in the 1840s, and then went to Virginia during the secession convention and said, I would rather have across the land famine and pestilence. That's a quote, famine and pestilence rather than end slavery. So, you know, nobody knew those stories, or Braxton Bragg, what a terrible person he was, or what a horrible general Polk was, or Hood. I mean, and nobody knew that Pickett was a war criminal who summarily executed 23 U.S. Army soldiers and skedaddled to Canada after the war rather than what he thought was going to be hanged. So that was part of it. We didn't get as much pro-Confederate, but people did say, and one Fort Bragg particularly, that said, if you change these names, there will be blood on the streets. A deputy mayor said that to me when I was down there. So there was certainly this sense that they didn't want to change, particularly at Bragg, because the other bases had either been through the base realignment process and thought they might close sometime. And that's what they were very worried about. Don't close. Fort Hood was, they had been through the Vanessa Guillen murder and also the number who had been killed in Iraq and Afghanistan. They were just a very traumatized place. So they were less worried about that than what it would effect it would have on the community. But Bragg was one that really didn't want to change.
Interesting. One of the wonderful things about the book, I think, is it is going to introduce a lot of people to aspects of American history, but also of the history of the United States Army that they didn't know. And I think you and your co-author have done a very artful job of weaving that in. And I was wondering, maybe you take one or two of the examples. You know, some of the people that are mentioned here, if you're sort of familiar with the United States Army, you will have heard of Harold Moore, who's this really truly heroic leader in this epic fight in the Yadrang Valley in, I guess, 1965 in Vietnam. Or Dick Cavazos was also, I think that was a familiar name, actually. I think I met him at some point. And that was long ago. But some of the others are not names that are familiar. And I was wondering if you could talk about some of them, because you know, some of the things that came out, for example, I had always sort of assumed that when Truman gives the order to desegregate the United States Army, that it happens pretty quickly. Actually, it doesn't. It's not until after Korea that it's really, you know, it really takes place. Or the struggles, you know, for women in general in the, as the Army creates what was then the Women's Army Corps, but particularly a Black woman serving as an officer, and, you know, and the things they did. So maybe if you could just talk about one or two of the characters who you think is most interesting, who most people, including even people like us, will really not have heard of, but have extraordinary and extraordinarily inspiring stories.
Yeah, I think one of the ones that I talk about is Arthur Gregg. And Gregg was born in South Carolina basically what was a plantation, went to a school, the Rosenwald Schools, which were created by the head of Sears Roebuck, who saw in the Black population what he had found in Europe among Jewish people. And so created this school system, created 5,000 schools in the American South for the Black population, of which Arthur Gregg went to one of them. I'd never heard of these until I started looking at that. So, and I found when I'm doing these stories is that by doing even these mini biographies, like, you know, just chapters, is that you find out about American history in ways that you never would have. So Gregg then, his mother dies, his father sends him to Norfolk to get a high school education with his brother. And he says, I want to make something out of my life. Tries a merchant marine and says, I do not like the sea. So comes back, then becomes a phlebotomist to try to draw blood. And then he can't get a job because he's black, then goes in to the army. And he's going to be the same thing. He's going to be a med tech. So he goes to Europe. But they, in 1946, when he joins, they won't allow him to draw white blood. So it's and blood is segregated through Korean War in the American army and into the 60s and 70s in some southern states. He then joins, goes to Germany, where they finally make him a supply sergeant and then a military, first black military police platoon ever, because they were having problems with that. They weren't allowed to have black platoons, black MPs then. He comes back, goes to OCS, goes to Fort Lee, not allowed to go into the officers club there, and finally rises through the ranks, commands the largest logistics battalion, a largest battalion period in Vietnam, becomes a hero there at Fort Lee, and becomes a three-star general, the first black three-star in the Army, and retires in that area and is a mentor ever since. And when we do the ceremony, Arthur Gregg is the first person that has been post-named for him who's alive in modern history. And he's there. I was there when he was 94 years old, ramrod straight, baritone voice, talking about he hopes his name will be an inspiration. And that ceremony started as a religious ceremony and ended as a block party, because Arthur Gregg was the one that really, he wasn't someone that said, I'm so upset about what happened in America. He says, look at me, 1946 segregated army. I eventually become a three-star. That's what America can be. And that's the inspiration that we can take from someone like Arthur Gregg. He was born into the America, which was not a democracy. Remember, we really weren't a democracy fully until after the Voting Rights Act in the 1960s. And Arthur Gregg, sort of his life is through that period.
Yeah. What nice little touch there. If I'm remembering correctly, is he the one who begins by thanking, I think, a sergeant? Who,
that's right.
And you have a beautiful commentary on that. You know, that's what the Army is all about. That somebody who ends up as a general has been shaped by some buck sergeant who kind of instilled in them some of the basics of what it is to be a soldier. As you went through this, I mean, I'll just tell you my reaction. On the one hand, I'm appalled. I'm even more appalled than I used to be. And I don't think I'm particularly naive about the history of the United States and towards the end of the 19th century and through much of the 20th. But I'm also amazed at how far we've come, even with our current troubles. And, you know, in a way you just touched on that. Which emotion dominated with you as you were digging out these stories?
Yeah. I think what the love of my country that came through in these stories, because these stories are people that overcame, and some of them, Henry Johnson, who served in World War I with the Harlem Hellfighters, when he finished his fight against the Germans, wounded, he killed I think he had 28 wounds and killed, I don't know how many dozen Germans. And then as he's going through Harlem afterwards, he's saying, they yell, here, his nickname, here comes Black Death. Dies penniless. Nobody knows that he's even where he's buried. He's buried in Arlington. And yet 100 years later, he receives the Medal of Honor posthumously. It's never too late to do the right thing. And so I came away from this experience loving the Army, loving my country in a way that if Robert E. Lee and me, I wrote about traitors for slavery. In this one, I wrote about those who overcame or just reflected the U.S. Army and this great nation in so many different ways. I have plenty of these great stories. So, you know, in 1861, there are enslaved people at West Point, enslaved, even though it's against the law in New York State, the Army has enslaved people. Less than 10 years later, there are black cadets there going through that will become officers. So we have this ability in America to change for the better rapidly, but it requires a fight every daggum time. And I think that's the other thing I got from this is that we can make change and positive change, but it requires fight and a continued fight, because as we know, history is never over. It just never ends. And something like these base names can be changed in a heartbeat, but that doesn't mean that it's going to stay that way. And I think that's the other great thing about writing this book, is that change can occur at any time.
I'd like to dig into some of the myth making, and we've talked a little bit about some of it, but there's so much more. And you you do a lot of myth busting, which I think is really salutary. But I mean, you know, so I went to a graduate school, you know, as I mentioned in the green room to study, you know, the history of the American South, with C. Van Woodward, a great Southern historian. And I mean, when I went to graduate school, I had two, you know, kind of different subjects in mind. One was America's role in the world, and the other was race relations, which is at the heart, I think, of the American story. And when I was a graduate student, you know, this was in the heyday of the revisionist historiography of Reconstruction, which had completely revised the received wisdom that, you know, Reconstruction was this terrible period when, you know, uneducated Black people and Northern scoundrels came down to the South and occupied it.
Carpetbaggers and scalawags.
Carpetbaggers and scalawags, and there was peculation and corruption. They stole money and all this. And Kenneth Stamp and a number of other historians, you know, I think completely kind of wiped that out. It was also a period of time when people were refocusing on the origins of the Civil War that undid the received wisdom of the 20s and 30s that it was not a war about slavery, that it was somehow about states' rights. Although whenever you peel beneath the surface, the rights that the states wanted to preserve were the right to hold other human beings in bondage. And that's just, you know, the reality. But could you talk a little bit about it? Because you have some wonderful sections where you talk about, you know, first of all, how do we refer to the war? You know, you can tell in the first 30 seconds, if you're talking to someone about the war, if they say it's the war of Northern aggression, you know what you're dealing with. But even when people say things like, well, it's the war between the states, as opposed to the formal term that the official history gave it, the War of the Rebellion or the Civil War. Could you unpack that a little bit, Ty? I think that would be of interest to people.
Yeah. I think it's, thank you. The language we use is so important. So how I started this in a way about what we call the war is I'm giving a tour and I'm there at Battle Monument, which, I know Elliot, you've been to at West Point, which is tall monument to those who served in the U.S. Army during the Civil War. We don't say the Union. There's no cemetery has the word Union on there. It's not anywhere. So it says those who served in the regular Army of the United States and during the War of the Rebellion, the official title, the War of the Rebellion. And the Southerners, again, white Southerners, started out saying this was going to be the War of Southern Independence. And of course, that didn't work out well. So then in the 1890s, they choose the War between the States as the way that they're going to describe this. It's the United Daughters of the Confederacy, Sons of Confederate Veterans. And what Jefferson Davis writes is the reason we should do this is that it was like fighting, like Germany and France fighting, not a civil war, whereas Lincoln would say, listen, this is an insurrection, a rebellion. And that's what's so important to remember, that this is an insurrection led by people who killed U.S. Army soldiers to create a slave republic. So I say it's the U.S. Army, not the Union Army. It's the United States of America against an insurrectionist force, a traitorous force. And remember, there's only one crime in the Constitution. That's Article 3, Section 3, which is levying war against the United States. That's a crime. And that's what they all did. And often say here, Ty, you're a presentist. You're putting your own values on this. But that's what Grant said. It's what Lincoln said. They all said these are traitors and they're insurrectionists. So the language we use is important. And I'll just say one other thing about this. We have said, we make Lee and Jackson, or the South made Lee and Jackson heroes. They never mentioned Longstreet. There was no statues to Longstreet. This is the great corps commander for Lee. And the reason is that because he becomes a Republican after the war, works with Grant, destroys a white supremacist militia in New Orleans. So the first statue really that goes up to him is in the 1990s after the movie Gettysburg comes out. He is considered a scalawag And that, as a kid growing up in Virginia, those were curse words you could say out loud, carpetbagger and scalaway. So yeah, this, the myths have been so, and they're created by the United Daughters of the Confederacy. These monuments that we see in front of the courthouse are important, but the most important monument they create are the children. And they're still the children of the Confederacy, still meets. You can still get scholarships by memorizing the catechism. I have my students read the catechism. The war wasn't about slavery. Slaves were happy in their condition. So it's still ongoing, even though the lies, we know it. Again, I call them lies because lies mean for a particular purpose, and it's pernicious, and that is to retain political power.
One of the things that I do want us to talk just a little bit about of Robert E. Lee and me before we kind of go back to the present. One of the things that's terrific about that book is, again, there are things I hadn't realized about Lee. Were you, as you went on your own migration, which maybe you could say a few words about, there's a lot of stuff about Lee that people don't realize. So, I mean, many people buy off of the myth. They say, well, I can't turn against my family. That's why I've got to fight for Virginia. Actually, a lot of his family was stuck with the United States. Well, everybody did it. No, actually, most of the colonels in the United States Army who were from Virginia stayed loyal. So if you could just walk through that and your reckoning with Lee, because I don't think anybody can read that book and come away thinking that this is a great man.
Let me add, Ty, if I could, one additional kind of request to what Elliot just asked you to address, which is Lee's generalship. Because I remember as a graduate student always thinking, you know, as I studied the war, Lee benefited early in the war from the fact that his opponents were terrible generals, not that he was really a great general. And you point out that at Gettysburg, he makes one of the worst military decisions probably in American military history. But I mean, I think it was only, you know, a decade or two ago that Alan Nolan, I think it was, wrote a very important book about, you know, Lee reconsidered as a general. But as a professional and a, you know, retired general officer yourself, I would appreciate your professional assessment of him as a commanding officer.
Well, you know, if somebody needs to dunk on Robert E. Lee, I'm your man. So let me start out on the non-military part. So it's kind of rapid succession here. First, he benefits from slavery more than any other officer in the United States Army. He spends 2.5 years on paid administrative leave running Arlington. His father-in-law kept enslaved families together. He breaks all of them apart. He whips those enslaved people who he captures and brings back. Then there are 9 U.S. Army colonels that are from Virginia, all West Point graduates. 8 remain loyal to the United States, and Lee and only Lee chooses treason, and many of his family members stay there. During the war, he goes, all of his logistics are enslaved. So he goes to the Gettysburg campaign, 8,000 to 10,000 enslaved people are his logistics. Then when he's there, every part of his army captures enslaved people, brings them back to Virginia for sale. Then in 1864, his army slaughters black prisoners of war. He refuses to accept them as soldiers. After the war, 2 weeks after, he says, if you don't treat the black people the way I think you should, we may have to go back to war. He testifies before Congress in 1866 saying, if it was up to him, we should ethnically cleanse. We should kick every black person out of the state of Virginia. He winks and nods toward the KKK in Lexington. This is not a person that we should honor. As for a military part of it, I've got mixed feelings about that. Most generals in the Civil War are terrible. Most of them. Because they go from the biggest thing they've ever commanded is a couple of hundred to now hundreds of thousands. So he does go up against weak generals, but they're mainly weak generals. And his strategy, which, you know, what do you do if you're the South? And it is trying to ensure that the North gives up. And that comes close a couple of times. So I'm not sure that his strategy was all that bad. He makes several blunders during the war, but then again, so does Grant. At Cold Harbor, attacks at Vicksburg. Lee was better than most, but until he comes across the greatest soldier ever to wear U.S. Army blue in Ulysses S. Grant. And by the end of the war, the United States has Grant, Thomas, Sheridan, and Sherman. And there is no way on God's sweet acre that you're going to defeat those people. And they finally get what Lincoln has been telling them, which is arithmetic, arithmetic. But up until Sherman takes Atlanta, there is still a chance that the Confederacy is going to win, because until Lincoln's elected in 1864, there's still a chance that McClellan would win that war and that catastrophe would occur for the United States and for the 4 million enslaved people. Remember, if the South had won, catastrophe for Black people, catastrophe for enslaved people, catastrophe for this country, because we would have been balkanized. It would have just been awful. So every time somebody says about the great things about the Confederacy, I want to say, well, what if? And that shuts him up.
To your point, Lincoln's insistence, I mean, Lincoln does not come into office with the intention of abolishing slavery. His major objective is to preserve the Union, and to preserve the Union because the possibility of liberty without the Union would vanish from the earth. That was his fear.
Can we leap back to the present? So one of the things that I find baffling about our current moment is here you have Pete Hegseth, a Secretary of Defense. He's not the Secretary of War, even if he calls himself that, because that's Congress gets to name the department. He doesn't. Anyway, a Secretary of Defense who has not received particularly kind treatment here on Shield of the Republic, but who is from Minnesota, is hell-bent on doing everything he can to get around the renaming of these bases. Now, by law, he can't rename them after Confederates, as I understand it. But instead, he resorts to this ridiculous artifice. Well, we'll find somebody else who passed through this fort who has the same last name. So they found a Benning. I don't know how many of the bases they've now, I think they did it with Cavazos. They renamed it Fort Hood, I believe. I don't know if they've been
able all of them.
All of them. So it's ludicrous. He's from Minnesota. You know, I would abhor it if this were simply sectional. You know, if this were simply people from the Deep South who can't let go of it. But my sense is that's not what this is. This is something else, and it goes, I think, in a way to what the symbols of the Confederacy somehow mean to unfortunately a large swath of people in the United States. And I wonder if, have you reflected on that? Do you have any insights you can share?
Well, I teach at Hamilton College, which is in upstate New York, and I can travel around upstate New York and see plenty of Confederate flags in upstate New York by the Civil War monuments. I mean, I'm in abolition country where I am. The Abolition Hall of Fame is down the road, and so many Americans fought for first for Union and then to end the scourge of human enslavement. So it is baffling in some cases. I think there are a couple of things to think about. First is that the United Daughters of the Confederacy and the people who reframed this war were extraordinarily successful. And it grew into a root. I don't know if you've ever been to the American South and know what kudzu is. So kudzu is a plant imported from China to erosion control and took over in the American South. And the roots go deep, 8 feet deep, huge, and it grows 18 inches a day. You can hear it growing. And so you can burn that field and these things still come up, because we've spent 150 years telling this story. If we go to the Civil War Centennial, blue and gray, they're brothers. You know, this was too bad. We shouldn't have had to fight this war. So the myths around it, and then it's reinforced by movies like Gone with the Wind. That was the first adult book I ever read. And people in 2014, they still said, what's the most popular book in America? People said the Bible first, Gone with the Wind second, and Lord of the Rings third, and Harry Potter fourth. So this is such a part of what we think. Also, there's this idea of rebel. So that the rebel that you're going against the man is big in many of these cases. Excuse my siren there. So I think there are a bunch of things going, but in the main thing, it is you don't know that the Civil War is about slavery. as there's so many people that just don't take that. I did this video for Prager, which is very conservative, 10 years ago, where I said the citizens of the southern states were willing to fight and die to preserve a morally repugnant institution. It went viral. The Army investigated me for political speech, for saying the Civil War was about slavery. I got death threats when I was at West Point. I took my phone number off the website at Hamilton College because I get all these crazies doing this. Now they call me on social media Taliban Ty. That's my, because I say that these Confederate statues don't, I'm not telling you to tear it down, but they don't reflect the values that we have. So we have some education to do, but I do think it's getting better. You know, they said the person who screens the history makes the history. I grew up on the Southern Lost Cause movies. Now I think it's changing. So, but man, it takes a lot of work. And Pete Hegseth, not the brightest bulb in the shop. Our worst, you have to go back to the Secretary of War under Buchanan to get to a secretary, to get to someone who was as bad as Pete Hegseth. So I'm with you. It's just a terrible choice. And I don't know how, more to say about that if you want to.
Yeah. Well, actually, and I mean, Buchanan's Secretary of War, that was what, Flood? And he becomes a Confederate
general. Flood, right. Floyd.
He becomes a Confederate general, I believe, right?
Right. And as Grant says in his memoir, he made the artillery and guns available when treason called.
Eric?
Can you bring us up to date on where this all stands? Because I know there's some activity again in the Congress to deal with what Elliot was talking about earlier, this effort to kind of at least in its most charitable interpretation, subvert the intent of the Congress by going back to the original names, if not the actual Confederate officers who these bases were named for originally.
Yeah. You know, as a historian, I keep thinking I'm going to write on things that have been complete, but I never do. So right now, the National Defense Authorization Bill is the nearly $1 trillion bill that funds the entire national security the Defense Department, DOD. And there's a Senate and House Armed Services Committee. The Senate's bill, which was passed by voice vote in the Senate, returns the three Virginia names. That's Tim Kaine that's really pushing that, to return the three Virginia names to what the commission said they should be and away from what Secretary Hegseth and Trump did. This House, and again, Republican control, the House, actually, their bill returned all of the bases to what we said, even though it's Republican control. Representative Bacon from Nebraska and one other from Kansas joined Democrats on that. So now the bill is in conference, and I don't know what's going to happen. There's a chance that five of the bases will return to what we're saying, maybe all of them, maybe none of them. I just can't tell. I don't know. Now, some of the things, all the portrait of Lee in Confederate gray with an enslaved servant in the background that was put up at West Point in 1952 as the Army was protesting integration, that's back at West Point. Many of the things that were named after that we took away at West Point are now back. So there's a bunch of, it's hard to even keep up with what's going on, but the Congress has a vote on this. Now, whether the Secretary of Defense or the President will do what Congress tells them, that's something else. But this is an ongoing fight to make sure that the soldiers that serve this great nation, that the bases reflect them and reflect this country today, and not Confederate traitors from 160 years ago.
The last question I'd like to ask is really about the United States Army, which you spent 30 years in the service. It's a wonderfully mixed portrait of the Army that you offer here, and even in some of the individual vignettes, in the Deep South during mobilization for World War II, some extraordinarily bad behavior, some extraordinarily good, brave behavior, and some that's very mixed, including, I think there's one case where General apologizes to a black female major. So it's, it's very much a mixed picture. How we're living in a fraught time. There's always been a kind of susceptibility in some quarters, I think, to white supremacist sorts of movements. I mean, this is, people have even said this about Hegseth's Deus Vult tattoo, which is a with the motto of the Crusaders, which has been associated with a lot of white supremacist movements. Do you worry about any kind of backsliding in the ranks of the army or any particular part of it during this time when you have leadership at the top of the Department of Defense that is so horrifically wrongheaded and retrograde in how they approach these questions?
Yeah, I think two things. The first is the army, the military is going to come through this. We're going to make it. You know, the army doesn't practice democracy. It executes democracy. We are one of the only countries in the history of the world that has never had a military coup d'etat. And I was so proud of the admirals and generals in that audience there that did just what they were supposed to do. And that is on the positive side. On the negative side, I think for young officers, particularly Black officers and women, it is extraordinarily hard right now. I mean, they fired so many of them. They fired the lawyers. At West Point, they did away with the sociology major. They did away with the Black history program that I started to talk about the history of the Black experience at West Point. They've done away with particularly the women's affinity groups, which, you know, the Army is a tough place for women because it's only 20% female, particularly at West Point. So there is, I fear that they're not going to go after sexual assault and sexual harassment like they should. You know, the Secretary of Defense now is the one that was arguing against the war criminals. And, you know, he had several war criminals in his unit in Iraq, and his brigade and commander and battalion commander were relieved for that. One of the great soldiers that I know, Pete Chiarelli, you know, was the division commander there. And he called him out on that. So it is going to be difficult for those who serve right now, which is, I think, for us, those who have served and those who talk about it, is just to say how much we appreciate their service to the nation at a time that is extraordinarily difficult.
Ty, you've been very generous with your time. Unfortunately, we could go on. I know I could go on with you for hours. First, thank you for what you have done on the commission and what you're continuing to do. I commend Robert E. Lee and me and A Promise Delivered to our audience. If you read them, as Elliot said, you will learn a lot about the history of the United States, the United States Army. And as this story progresses, I hope we can have you back.
Well, Eric, what an honor it is to be with two public servants like both of you. It is an honor and a privilege to be with both of you. And thank you for what you've done and what you continue to do. You know, at this period where it takes courage to call out those in power, I'm always appreciative of those who do.
Well, thank you. And thanks. You know, I think one other thing to be grateful for here is it is the spirit of optimism with, you know, you've described yourself coming away with at the end of this project. That's at a time when a lot of people are disappointed and when the changing of these names back, it seems like a real step backward. I think you're there's something tonic about having that that optimistic look at the future. And the truth is, actually, I expect that the name changes that you and the commission put forward will stick. I guess I should say to our listeners, we're not going to tape another show during Thanksgiving week unless there's some national emergency, in which case, of course, Shield of the Republic will step forward, as we always do, and we'll be thinking about what we are thankful for, and that includes the kind of patriots that we have on the show, including our guest, Ty Sedgley. Thank you.
At a Mobility Chiropractic, we believe every child deserves to grow up healthy, strong, and connected to the incredible power within their own body. From infants to adults, our doctors specialize in purposeful chiropractic care that restores balance between the brain and body, helping you and your family live and heal the way you were designed to, naturally. Families across Columbus are choosing to build lifelong wellness from the start. Discover what true health feels like at Ability Chiropractic. Schedule your visit today at abilitychiro.com.
COTA just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your COTA fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with COTA. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.